Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live from Bowie, Maryland. Tonight, the talk of the town in the Republican primary. Vulture capitalism. Leveraged buyouts. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can reach us at 347-945-6713. Again, that's 347-945-6713. And we're going to have a good time talking about Bain Capital. Just so that we have a little bit of background to talk about. First of all, Bain Capital was a private equity company. It came out of another company, but a private equity company is a company that takes money and invests it in companies to make more money. And they perfected a kind of buying that minimized risk to the investors, maximized profits, and as Governor Perry of Texas said, they would sit on trees like vultures waiting for the companies to go terminal so that they could pick the bones bare. If you don't think that's a fair characterization of them, by all means, 347-945-6713. We want to hear from you. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about the debate last night in South Carolina. Everybody's all up in arms about some of the things that Newt Gingrich had to say. It was really a pretty interesting debate last night. That, of course, another issue from last night, which we're open to talk about, do you think felons should be allowed to achieve their voting rights? And as long as we're talking about felons, we might as well add Haley Barbour's hundreds of pardons into the mix and talk about it. Really pretty interesting that in this era of heightened security that most of the trustees that worked in the governor's mansion were convicted murderers, you know, where any one of them had access to the governor and plenty of weapons, at least as compared to the weapons they might have access to in a regular prison. I mean, if you're the governor's cook, you got to cook something for him. I mean, what can I say? So I got plenty of lines open. They tell me 50 now that I'm in the premium chat room. So let's talk about Bain Capital first. It was founded in 1984 in Boston, Massachusetts. In 26 years, it increased its net worth to about $66 billion. The principal function of Bain Capital is to invest in and buy companies, and to try to turn those investments into more dollars. They don't particularly care what the company makes. They're not particularly interested in whether anybody really needs the stuff. They're not interested in improving the lot of the people that work for the company or the quality of the products that the company buys. That's not what they're into. What they're into is finding a company that they believe they can make money from by buying it. Some of the companies that Bain Capital has acquired. And, oh, by the way, we're looking at Bain Capital, of course, because that's the company that Mitt Romney had. And I'm telling you, there's something, but we'll talk about that, I guess, when we talk about the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, later on in the program, if we get that far. But we'll see. But here's the point. But here's some of the, we're talking about Bain Capital right now, and its exercise of pure profit-making capitalism. Companies that they acquired, AMC Entertainment, I'm sure you've all been to an AMC movie house. To Burger King, who hasn't had a Whopper? Burlington Coat Factory. Clear Channel Communications, which, by the way, was the company that fired Howard Stern for good from the commercial, from the commercial airways. Domino's Pizza was acquired and turned around by Bain Capital. I believe Dunkin' Donuts has the best cup of coffee that I can find anywhere. Something special about Dunkin' Donuts coffee. They were a Bain Capital acquisition. Staples is their big claim to fame. Oh, look what we did for Staples. Toys R Us, the Weather Channel, all Bain Capital materials. Now, Bain Capital has offices around the world. They have offices in, they started in Boston. They have offices in Europe, in London, in Hong Kong, other places in Asia. Bain Capital did not invent, but they indeed specialized and perfected the leveraged buyout. And it's really kind of a, I find it to be distasteful, but then I guess I don't really understand capitalism and everything that goes with it, or at least that's what people tell me. And well, hopefully in a little bit we can talk about Schrumpeter's idea of destructive renewal or whatever he calls it. Come on, give me a call. 347-945-6713. Let me see what I can. Joseph Schrumpeter. Oh, gosh. Does anyone know who Joseph Schrumpeter was? Give me a call. 347. He was a capitalist theorist or a capitalist apologist in some quarters. So let's read some quotations from Joseph Schrumpeter. Bureaucracy is not an obstacle to democracy, but an inevitable complement to it. Bureaucracy is probably the worst element of the modern nation state, at least in my mind. And as you move towards fascism, where every, but this is Norman Constantine now, not Joseph Schumpeter, as you move towards capitalism or fascism, and more aspects of your lives get controlled by the state, the state has to build more and more apparatuses to control that life. And it's really sad that we can think that bureaucracy is an inevitable complement, as Schrödinger says, to democracy. This is the beauty. Capitalism inevitably, and by virtue of the very logic of its civilization, creates, educates, and subsidizes a vested interest in social unrest. I do not believe that capitalism does any of the one. Well, here's another Schrödinger quote. Economic progress in capitalist society means turmoil. I guess the turmoil comes from the losers starving to death. Marxism is essentially a product of the bourgeois mind. There's an interesting idea. I'm glad I looked these Schrödinger quotes up. Our poverty will be brought home to us to its full extent only after war. He says the ballot is stronger than bullets. I guess that may be the case. Hey, I got a caller coming in. Hey, you're on with Norm. Go ahead.
How's it going tonight?
It's going all right. I know I said I'd call you for some pregame, but unfortunately it didn't work out.
Oh, no problem.
I'm glad you called. Well, anyway, I'm giving a little lecture here about Bain Capital.
Oh, yeah.
A nearly extinct species of vulture. Remember, if you want to join in on this conversation, it's 347-945-6713. You can call in. We got plenty of calls for you. And you can also come into the chat room. And there's just calls of me in there now. But if you want to come into the chat room and leave some comments, we'll be sure the audience in general hears them. But anyway, where was I here? Oh, yeah, some of the companies that Bain Capital acquired. As I said, they have offices around the world. Now, just what do these private equity companies do? They don't make anything. They don't produce anything. Except money.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually use somebody else's money to do it.
Right.
It's always better to play with somebody else's money than with your own. So what does one of these companies do? By the way, the leveraged buyout was invented in 1955. That's the first time one of these things was ever conceived. It's not, as some people would have you believe, something that was invented in the mind of Mitt Romney. He's not that original, I don't think. But anyway, and the biggest leveraged buyout ever was the RJ Nabisco buyout in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
That was a company completely destroyed. What was the name of that book? The Barbarians at the Gate?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was that it?
I
can't remember. I
don't know. I mean, I know the title, but was it only about... I haven't... Oh, shoot.
It was...
I don't think I've ever read that, no.
Barbarians at the Gate, The Fall of R.J.R. Nabisco.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a film of it, too.
Yeah.
When did that happen? I thought it was 1984.
Yeah, well... Well, here was the thing. You know, tobacco companies back then had a lot of money. And they sought to diversify, which is how R.J. Reynolds bought Nabisco, which is how Philip Morris bought Miller Brewing.
Right, they were trying to get their money out of tobacco.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it was like the mafia investing in Las Vegas. Same thing.
I guess. Well, hold that, since you seem to know a bit about. Hold that for a minute. Because I want the people out there listening to get some idea of what a leveraged buyout is. Bunch of people get together. And they look for companies that have essentially low valuations and lots of assets. Then they buy the company or invest in the company, however you want to look at it, and they buy the equity of the company. But the way that they do it is they borrow money and then use the assets as collateral for the borrowed money. Now, these sort of make bonds, but unfortunately, these bonds don't have any real value and they're very hard to sell. I have no idea why anybody buys these things, but they do. But then... And this is actually when you get a winner if you hold these bonds. The hard assets are sold. And if you can sell them for more than you borrowed, everybody makes money. If you can't sell them for more than you borrowed, the people you borrowed the money from lose the money, not you. The object is money. Money, money, bingo. No products, no production. Sometimes they'll try to increase cash flow, but the very interesting way that it's done is for the short term. A lot of this is editorial comment on my part.
Mm-hmm.
For the short term, by worker salaries and benefit reductions, which increase cash flow, but depress the stock price. Again, they began in 1955. The biggest buyout was R.J. Reynolds Nabisco. And that's my little talk on leveraged buyouts. But when they buy a business and then resell it in an IPO, and that's really scummy. And essentially they form a new company, so then all the contracts are void. Secondary buyouts are another way to go about it. Businesses that grow slowly but produce really interesting cash flows are also targets.
Oh, you're missing one of the... Oh, at least during the 80s, this was, I wouldn't call it prevalent, but it was done quite a bit. And this would be, this would qualify as vulture capitalism. When you found a company that had a pension fund, and the pension fund was overfunded, that became a very lucrative target. Because once you got a hold of the company, then
you could do anything you wanted with the pension fund.
Well, you defund it or fund it, you know, take enough out of it to where the, it's properly funded, but there's no excess. And sometimes that could be very lucrative. That was very popular in the 80s, late 80s mostly.
If you just kept taking it, that's right, because that's when the 401k started to come into existence.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one other thing, at the present, you got to remember when you're saying leveraged buyouts, of course, that's borrowed money on top of borrowed money. And why those bonds were so lucrative was if they were successful, they could pay sometimes 10 to 1.
Oh, I know.
I mean, they were junk, and, you know, that was also the era of Michael Milken. And they were, it was nothing but gambling. I mean, there was no, to call it an investment is, you know, obviously you could spread your risk out, which is pretty much how leverage works. That's why you've got, in a lot of the deals that Bain Capital made, they had a lot of partners that came in there with them. Goldman Sachs.
Well, exactly.
You borrowed their money
to do your work.
And KKR, all the big investment houses were you know, partners in this. So everybody would have a little chunk, 10%, this, that, whatever. And that's sensible business practice. You know, it's one thing to bet all your money on one investment. And it's another if you spread it across, let's say, 50 different investments. So if you lose 10%, no problem. You know,
your money.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a simple diversification, you know. And that's how these guys pretty much work, you know.
You know, we just keep going back to the same thing. On the stock market, they call it margin.
Well, for the individual, it's margin, yes. I use margin. Yeah. They use leverage. But I can use leverage.
Margin buying is leveraged buying.
Well, it is, but we distinguish between margin, you know, which
Unfortunately, your leverage has no collateral.
No, my margin is full, almost, well, initially, it's 100%, and if I lose, it may be whatever. And if it gets down to 30%, then I get a call, you know. But that's true for these guys as
but
well.
But if the stock's worth a dollar, and you buy it at 50% margin, you give them 50 cents.
Right. Right. Well.
And so you owe them 50 cents.
Right. So
anytime the stock's value goes below 50 cents, you have to make up the difference.
Well, I have to once it hits only where it's 30. You know, if I have a dollar, I can borrow a dollar. Okay? Now, if the stock loses 20 cents, I've lost 40 cents. Because I've lost part of their money and part of my money.
And you have to come up with it. You have to answer the market call.
Yeah, well, the market call won't happen until it drops to 30%. But I'm just saying, you know, you double your risk when you're using margin. So,
but the point is, when the margin call occurs, the stock must be sold and they get their money.
Right. If you don't come up with, you know, more collateral, then they have the option of selling. They'll usually give you a couple days, you know, because they don't want to do this to you.
Right, they don't want to call the margin because they take a beating too.
Yeah,
but
well, they're
going
like because it's conceivable, you know, that they would lose money and you would owe them money, and, well, then it's up to them to collect it.
Like if you owe them $1 and can only sell the stock for 80 cents, you got to give them the 80 cents plus 20 more.
Right, exactly. I've got to, you know.
Like
I've
going upside down on a mortgage.
Right. I've got to pay back everything I borrowed plus whatever interest, you know.
Right.
And
interest
will run, I think it's running maybe around 9% annual right now.
Is it really?
Yeah. Oh, they have no
reason. Who gets first claim on the dividends?
Oh, you get the dividend. But what happens is the dividend is actually subtracted from the margin. As soon as that cash comes in, it goes there.
So in other words, if you owed $1 on the margin, there was a 20 cent dividend.
Yeah,
it gets paid directly to the margin.
That's where it should go. So... because remember, at that point, you have no cash in your account. So, anyway, getting back to Bain, over the last few years, of course, the credit markets have completely dried up, and they aren't doing a whole lot of what they used to do. It's just not there, you know. There's still a few other.
I can't buy on the margin?
No. There isn't enough money for them to borrow, and people aren't lending. Banks aren't lending. Got to remember, after 2008, a whole lot of credit dried up, and it has not come back.
So what are the private equity companies doing now? Using their own money? God, no.
They're doing, they're smaller deals and generally more conservative investments. But the large-scale buyouts, you still see them. In fact, I'm involved in one right now that...
Really?
It's not favorable for me. No, not at all. But I have a small Canadian gold miner. And...
Uh-huh.
There's a group called Luxor, which is trying to buy it at a ridiculous price, very low price. And it's above the current market price, the stock price. But we're talking pennies. This is a penny stock. So anyway, for unknown reasons, the stock dropped dramatically over the course of a year. It had been valued up around maybe $1.20, $1.30, and dropped down in December it had hit as low as 30 cents. So they made an offer of 56 cents. Of course, they made it in January and said, we're giving you a 60% premium over your price over the last 60 days.
Okay.
And, of course, it's absolutely absurd. I mean, the property alone is worth more than that. But
And that's what these guys do.
Yeah, well, here's the deal. They only own about maybe 5.6% of the outstanding shares. They're asking the shareholders to more or less give them control of their stock, and by doing so, they want to take control of the company. And once they do that, then they buy everyone out 56 cents a share.
They want to buy the 51%. They only need to buy 51%.
Well, yeah, they could, but then getting rid of the board is not that easy. Plus, the board has already introduced a poison pill, so, you know, that's in there, too.
And what is a poison pill? Explain that to the listeners.
Okay. Well, they make it, they create a situation that would make it extremely costly for the acquirer, Luxar Group, to carry through with their plans. And what they will do is offer all of the shareholders another opportunity to buy stock. And they'll sell all this stock at a much reduced price. So let's say I have 10,000 shares, and the current
market... They'll give you options on another 20,000.
Right, and they'll do it at maybe half the price of the offering price that Luxor is proposing.
And they'll make the options good until the offer expires.
Right, exactly. And the way it works now, the poison pill is good for a month after the expiration of the offer. So if Luxor wants to follow through, they're going to have to pay probably double or maybe even triple what they're offering.
The way the company defends itself...
That's one method, yeah.
...is to make it cost more than it's worth to buy it.
That's the deal.
And what is a golden pair... a white knight?
That'd be someone who comes in to rescue the company with maybe a better offer or a big loan of some sort, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like Warren Buffett did with Bank of America, you know, where he takes all preferred shares, collects 10% interest. So that's sort of a white knight. A white knight with his hand in your pocket, but...
But the most important part of all of this is that none of it produces anything.
Yeah, exactly. The production continues as is. It's going to be managed, you know, presumably to the best of the, company's ability. But this has nothing to do with the production and all of that, you know. And
very few leveraged buyouts result in the borrowers continuing in the company.
Most of the time, they really aren't interested in the business. No,
that's correct.
Yeah, and that's not their job.
And so, what you're saying is. Mitt Romney's sort of fibbing when he says he creates jobs.
Yeah, they never bought any, you know, these companies they bought most of the time, they were interested. It would be no different than me, you know, buying a car from my neighbor down the street and having it repainted and selling it for twice what I paid, you know.
Your neighbor down the street, an old lady with a 68 GTO in the garage.
Yeah,
it's all beat up,
mm-hmm.
and she has no idea what it is, and you give her $50 for it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's happy just to have it taken away.
Yeah, precisely.
Even better yet, you come and borrow the $50 from me. Just in case, you know, it turns out the motor's gone. And so if that is the case, I get a car with no motor.
Mm-hmm.
When I cash in for the collateral to my loan.
Mm-hmm. But, you know... But here's the thing. I don't know exactly what to call it, but you have, you know, different interpretations of, you know, of what a company should do or should be. Now, most people, particularly investors, will say the company is there solely for the benefit of the shareholders and to make money for them. You know, and, you know, they have a point. The other is that you have companies that obviously are part of a community and have involvement with government. And they have a certain amount of responsibility to the communities they're in, certainly environmental issues. And for the most part, it's good business to do that. They pretty much want their workers to be happy and paid adequately. And they want to produce good products that people enjoy and people use, and you know, that it builds their market if their reputation is good.
And the companies that do, and the companies that do this stuff are the ones that these leveraged buyout companies look for like hawks.
Well,
and they buy them and then liquidate them.
Well, okay, here's the thing with the, you know, they may sell it off in pieces, you know, where the parts are greater than the whole, you know, that, you know, so they recognize value.
They do that a lot.
Well, but that's legitimate.
You know, just like your gold mine.
I mean,
land, you know, could be used for growing things. You know, and the cattle farmers will pay a fortune for it.
Mm-hmm. Where's this going?
Well, but that's the whole point. Anyway, there's one thing I always get a I always get a kick out of this. You know, they talk about the purpose of these leveraged buyout companies, these private equity is for creative destruction.
Right.
You know
right.
where the term originally came from?
Oh, I'm trying to remember where I first heard that, but
well, I don't know where you first heard it, but I can tell you where it was first written.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the Communist Manifesto.
Oh, okay. That makes
creative creative destruction is a term originally derived from Marxist economic theory. It refers to the linked processes of accumulation and annihilation of wealth under capitalism. These processes were first described in the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah. Well, it could describe the most of the Marxist movements, and certainly a revolution is creative destruction.
Some people would say that.
I mean, you know, I mean, they did. You know, the thing about Marxism is that, or let's say communism, is that it has had success, nominal success, but you know, you can't say that the Cuban Revolution wasn't successful, especially for the average person. And you could also say that, I'm just saying, living conditions improved dramatically. Then they stopped. Then they went nowhere, you know. The same would be true for Soviet Russia, up to a point. Once it became completely militarized, then, they wasted everything. Of course, they wasted it on weapons and space programs and enormous armies, and those don't produce any revenue, do they?
No, armies do not produce revenue.
Yeah, part of our problem, too.
It's a big part of our problem.
Yes, of course. So, you know, I take issue with, you know, with people who say that, you know, I mean, you can say, yes, Marxism and or communism does not work, but initially it does work, and it definitely does improve the lower class of society. But
it improves the general living of the society.
Well, the general, right. But what that means is that a lot of people come down and while others go up. But then they stay at this plateau and they never move from that point, you know.
Very few people actually go to... Hey, here's one thing I want to get out on the air tonight that I discovered today, and I found this astounding. There are more black men in prison today, January 17, 2012, than there were slaves in 1850.
Oh.
That is astounding. It's Ronnie Paul is the only guy talking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody likes the golden rule.
Mm-hmm. So, I didn't catch that last debate, so I don't know how much, you know.
The one last night, it was a dilly.
I've sort of tuned it. I've been tuning it out, you know, only because the rhetoric is, you know, it's beyond absurd at this point.
Hey, come on out there, 347-945-6713. Give us a call. Argue some economics with us. But the debate last night, there were some real high points. Everybody's upset with... Speaker Gingrich. He was in rare form last night.
Mm-hmm.
The best one, everybody's mad at him because he called, Juan Dixon was the moderator last night, and he was asking Newt some hard questions about the janitor thing.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody's mad because Newt says, come on, Juan. And then he waited for the crowd to cheer.
There were some
moments we call. Everybody's been going nutty about it today on TV. He called Obama the food stamp president.
Oh, that again. Yeah. Well, you know. Now, you know, the problem isn't that food stamps have been, the program has not been expanded. The people who qualify have expanded. No one could have done anything about that.
Well, that's the whole point of it. But, and, because everybody's making a big deal about it, Gingrich has been successful with what he intended to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you something about California. We have among the lowest participation in food stamps. Couple other names for it, but it's essentially food stamps. And the reason is that we've made it so complex that most people give up before they ever get to the end of the process.
I can remember people sitting outside liquor stores and selling their food stamps for 25 cents on the dollar so they could go in and buy.
Yeah, well, they do it different ways now, but because they have these cards, I think, what are they called? Yeah, they have these
cards. Yeah, everybody uses debit cards.
So you go in with the card, and you can buy your alcohol and cigarettes.
Right.
But the storekeeper will ring up food. You know? And that's more or less how it works, you know.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that in the old days they were negotiable.
Oh, yeah, I think. Well, were you in Buffalo for the big blizzard? You know,
I was not.
Oh,
I had just gone to Maryland.
Well, anyway, after the blizzard, we all got like 2-3 weeks unemployment insurance, and everybody got, I think it was $140 in food stamps. And all you had to do was go downtown and pick them up. And to use them, you didn't need any ID or anything. You just used them like money. And I remember there were incredible lines wherever the office was downtown. And these people were down there with bottles of whiskey and fur coats, just drinking beer and whatever else they had. And
yeah,
you know,
well.
And it, well,
anybody
no one,
out there? I don't want to talk about welfare queens. Anybody out there? 347-945-6713. Give us a call. Tell us what you thought about Newt Gingrich yesterday and his performance.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Newt has a point that, you know, I mean, in terms of work, yes, work is preferable to welfare, but he's not coming up with solutions that make any sense, you know.
I know that, but he had a great line that went something like, yeah, I want people to want to get a job, and then to own that job.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a whole lot of vacancies. Call farm work. But Americans won't do farm work. I wonder why.
No,
are they fat and lazy?
No.
Is it too hard?
Well, the fact of the matter is,
that's what everybody says, it's too hard.
There aren't enough people to do farm work.
There are plenty of people to do farm work.
No, there isn't.
Well, I don't know. How many unemployed do we have now?
It's not that simple. You don't have a job making cars, so now you have a job picking tomatoes. It's not that simple.
I don't know. If I'm hanging around with no money and no home and whatever, or I have a family to feed, I should be doing everything I can. You know,
I don't dispute that.
You know what? Yeah. See, this is a deal. Remember when we disputed unions and all that in the past. You know, in the 70s, I took jobs that, you know, were like temp jobs. And I did whatever the hell it was. It didn't matter what it was. And one job in particular, I was down at the Mobile Refinery down in South Buffalo. And it was the middle of winter. And they want us to dig drainage ditches. This is in frozen ground. And the reason, you know why we got those jobs? Because the union refused to do it. So there was me and this other guy, and we were there with the shovels and all kinds of protective plastic stuff and boots and what have you. And we're digging in frozen ground trying to dig this drainage ditch. And, of course, all the union guys are standing around watching us work, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes. But I had to remember that if these guys didn't refuse to do that job, I wouldn't have my job. Remember I told you not everyone had good experiences with unions. Well, that's one of mine.
Well, no, I had, you know, where somebody had to crawl down in, I don't even know what you call it, where the blast furnace, where all the condensation drained off. And, you know, the laborers had to do it.
Yeah, well, you know, well, it was no different in the military. The lowest ranked guy got the worst job. I mean, that's just how it was. But it wasn't as if they hired other people to do it.
347-945-6713.
You know, but
I'm a little disappointed.
The only point I'm trying to make is that, you know, I did that type of work because I had to. And, you know, I don't, if I were in, you know, a really difficult position, now I'm probably too old to even consider it, you know, going out to the fields around here and picking tomatoes. I mean, you know, I probably wouldn't last more than a couple hours, you know. But for healthy people, you know, who need money, Jesus Christ. I mean, you take what's there. That's all there is to it, you know.
Yeah, but what about taking those healthy people, giving them the land, let them grow and sell their own tomatoes?
You want to give them land
to grow and sell their own tomatoes?
Yeah, well, let's see. I think my land here is worth about $80,000, and that's only 7,000 square feet. You want to give them that? And that wouldn't grow enough food to feed more than one person. Probably not even that much.
40 acres and a mule.
Yeah, well, you know.
There's plenty of land in this country.
Well, there is, but, you know.
Most of it's controlled by the tree huggers.
Well, you know, 40
acres and a mule.
Yeah, it would be nice. It would be a great thing.
People never got it after the Civil War. They were supposed to.
Okay, well.
40 acres and a mule.
Well, if you want to bring back the Homestead Act, you know.
The Homestead Act is still on the books.
Okay, well, let's hitch up our wagon. And problem for me is if I go west, I end up in Hawaii.
Let's have another land rush. Why not?
Oh, you know, to a small extent, you know, there are collectives of, you know, farms, small farms and that around here who are actually doing that kind of thing. And, I mean, these people literally just work their farm and, you know, they're selling organic produce and they're selling, you know, specialty stuff. But it is sort of working. I mean, there's a good market for that. So we've got
there's a crisis of expectation, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to do something about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because certainly, you know, when I get out with my my bachelor's degree, I don't expect to be pumping gas. Well, there are no jobs pumping gas anymore. But I don't expect to be sweeping floors, okay?
No, but you might be.
But you might be, exactly.
And what you're talking about is being willing to go and start sweeping the floor.
Right, okay. And that would
and
be...
What people are talking about with the American dream, you know, you start out sweeping the floor and you end up in the executive suite. Can you still do that? I don't think so.
It's highly unlikely. I mean, we do have the few who make it that way. But, you know, let's put it this way. I mean, we're talking, what, a third of the country with college degrees, something like that?
Not, oh, gosh, no. 20% max.
Oh, I thought it was more than that. I thought it was around
30%. No, everybody thinks it's more than that.
Okay, well.
About
30%,
about 30% of the people who graduate from high school That's the graduates. That's not counting the people that don't. 30% of the high school graduates go on to some form of post-high school education.
Okay.
And of that number, only about half ever get some kind of degree. And only about three-quarters of that half get four-year college degrees.
Mm-hmm.
The number's not that big, fans.
Yeah.
You know,
okay, well,
it's like you try to, like the classes I used to teach, you try to see everybody's in a world where everybody goes to college. That's a very artificial world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's look at it, you know, okay, now, so what you're telling me is that 80% of the people are left behind.
80% of the people don't
meaning
go
they,
to higher education.
They may, right, 80% did not, they may or may not have graduated from high school, but they never achieved anything beyond that.
Right.
Now, those people are going into the job market with, you know, nominal skills.
They're going into the job market with zero skills.
Well, I'm saying, you know, they can read and write. They may have some level of computer literacy. I don't know. I mean, from what I'm hearing now, you know, there are a lot of what we used to call trades jobs, you know, the welders and the mechanics and tool and die guys and all that. You know, and
yeah,
now there's a shortage.
That.
And so what happened
everybody
there?
Wait a minute, caller. Everybody says that. But
mm-hmm.
the fact is robots are doing more and more of those jobs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I understand.
You know, one master welder controls a bunch of robots doing
yeah.
the welds that people used to do.
In fact,
automobile manufacturers, welds, do it all.
Oh, sure. But, I mean, I think...
But anyway, we're down to the last 2 minutes here. Anything you want to say?
I've been talking for well over half an hour.
I know. Well, it's been a good show. We talked about a lot of important things, and I don't know why nobody calls, because plenty of people listen, and plenty of people listen to the archives.
So
we'll be here next week again talking about the South Carolina primary and what happened on Saturday and what's going to happen the next Tuesday in Florida. But I think I'm going to go out of here tonight with American Blues. I'm going to let it play right through to the end.
Okay.
So this is Norm at Night saying to America, we got a lot of bad habits, and this is for you. Talk to you next week.
Okay, take care, man. Good night.
All right, good night.
I ran a Harley Davidson, I got a big tattoo, but what the doctor says is really cute.